There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's Community News Program, Off the Hour. Today is August 13th. My name is Brian Jefferson, and I will be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and the Kanyenkehaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
Radio. Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
First, news. Canada fully reopened its border for vaccinated U.S. tourists this week. Travelers with two doses of a COVID-19 vaccine are allowed in without having to quarantine. One-third of recent COVID-19 cases in Montreal have come from travelers outside of Canada. That's according to David Kaiser, head of the Environmental Health Unit at the city's Public Health Department. He warned of rising variant cases during a press conference on Thursday. And some universities are announcing their back-to-school plans for the fall. McGill and Concordia said their students will be required to wear masks in classrooms, but physical distancing will only be required in high-traffic areas. McGill Student Society published an open letter Thursday asking that McGill mandate masks everywhere indoors and make remote learning an option for all. And this week was the 13th anniversary of the death of Freddy Villanueva. He was 18 years old when he was shot and killed by a Montreal police officer in a park while he was playing dice with his friends. Villanueva's death has been at the center of local opposition to police brutality for over a decade now. Last week, police officers shot and killed Jean-René Olivier after responding to a distress call about Olivier's signs of psychosis. And experts say Canadians can expect a federal election on September 20th. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is planning to ask for a dissolution of the current parliament, and the decision will be made official on Saturday. Montrealers are still planning to vote for city seats in November. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
Sam's excited to see his favorite band play live. He's thought about it all week. He bought his ticket. He wore his band t-shirt. He went to the concert venue. He wasn't allowed inside the concert venue. He put away his band t-shirt. He threw away his ticket. And he thought about it all week.
Don't wait until it hits you. Get vaccinated. Beginning in September, you'll need a vaccination passport to enter certain public spaces. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is 5:05. My name is Brian Jefferson. Up first on this episode,
we're going to tune into a show from CKUT's very own Prison Radio. It aired yesterday on the occasion of the annual Prisoners' Justice Day. That was on August 10th. It was a day when people inside prisons and outside take a minute to pause, remember, and look towards something different, a new type of collective care for the future.
We'll tune in and bring you back at the top of the hour, where we'll have more local news for you to use.
KUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune into the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, and every second Thursday of the month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio, or if you need to access past programs, email prison@ckut.ca.
Yes, rehabilitation.
I wonder if you know what the word means. Do you? It comes from the Latin root habilis. The definition is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
Number, you weren't a man, you want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Virginia, and I'm your host for today's show. Today's show will feature audio from Montreal's Prisoner Justice Day event, which happened on Tuesday, August 10th, from 6 until 9 p.m. in Parc Vinet in Little Burgundy. The audio will explain what Prisoner Justice Day is, as well as share stories from people's experiences in prison, and why abolition is the only way forward. We hope you enjoy the show. The speeches are half in English and half in French. Up first is the event's MC, Joanne Wendy Barreto, talking about the history of Prisoner Justice Day.
So my name is Joanne Wendy Barreto. I'm a lifer, proud of it, meaning that I survived it, and I'm here to help others survive it, because it is survival. Doesn't matter what CSC tells you, they're not helping. If you survive it, it's because you're strong and persistent. And everybody that I know that have managed to leave jail are strong people. We stayed alive, persevered, and got out. And even the ones that are still inside are persevering, are strong people. Excuse me. On August 10th, 1974, prisoner Eddie Nalen bled to death in his segregation unit of Melhaven Maximum Security Prison located in Bath, Ontario. Melhaven was brand new at the time, having only been open a few years before and already had a reputation for being a brutal institution. Eddie was serving a life sentence and had been in and out of segregation from the start of his sentence. Even though Eddie took his own life, evidence clearly showed that the blame belonged solely to the prison system and its apathetic administrators. On the first anniversary of Eddie's death, August 10th, 1975, prisoners at Melhaven refused to work, went on a one-day hunger strike, and held a memorial service, even though it would mean a stint in solitary confinement. Many of the alleged leaders in this one-day peaceful protest would still be in segregation a year later. Note, although refusing to eat and refusing to work are among the only options for peaceful protest available to prisoners, both were viewed as disciplinary offenses and prison administration. On May 21st, 1976, another prisoner died in segregation unit of the Millhaven prison. Bobby Landers was very active and outspoken in the struggle for prisoners' rights. He had been doing his time in Archambault maximum security. He was one of the inmates committee at Archambault, where prisoners were in the process of organizing a prison strike to better conditions inside. Bobby was involuntarily transferred to Millhaven just before the strike in January 1976 and was thrown into the hole. On the night before he died, Bobby tried to get medical help. However, a panic button in his cell had still not been repaired. He wanted to see the nurse, who could be heard laughing and talking with guards out in the office at the end of the range. He and three other prisoners all called out for her to come on the range, but were ignored by both the nurses and the guards. In the morning, they found Bobby dead, and a scribbled note on his bed that requested medical aid and described symptoms that indicated a heart problem. At the inquest into his death, it was determined that he had died from a heart attack, and a heart specialist confirmed that he should have been in intensive care unit, not in solitary confinement. It's been 45 years since Bobby Landers died, and Prisoner's Justice Day started being recognized across the country and was changed, basically, and has changed basically nothing. By August 10, 1976, thousands of prisoners across Canada went on a one-day hunger strike while Prison Justice Day Committee reformed in Quebec, Ontario, and British Columbia to organize committee events that drew attention to the prisoners' concerns. Almost every federal institution recognized the day, and hundreds of prisoners participated. Prisoners' Justice Day became International Day of Solidarity with Prisoners. In 1983, prisoners in France refused to eat in recognition of August 10th. The following statement was read in the prison in the Paris radio station Fréquence Libre. Why not have an August 10th, an International Day of Solidarity with our imprisoned brothers and sisters? For here or elsewhere, prison kills. Whether it be Nellin in Ontario, Batter in Mainoff in West Germany, Claude or Yvonne in Switzerland, Bobby San in Ireland, Mirav, Hajaji, Hona, Youssef, or so many others in France, whether they are serving 50 years like Alexandre Côté or 16 years like Youssef, whether they are considered political or common prisoner, prison kills. By the mid-1990s, prisoners in parts of Germany, England, and the United States would join this day in protest. In 2001, the Prisoners Justice Day Committee in Vancouver wrote this statement about the Prisoners Justice Day. What is Prisoners Justice Day? August 10th, the day prisoners have set aside as a day to fast and refuse to work in a show of solidarity to remember those who have died unnecessarily, victims of murder, suicide, and neglect. The day when organizations and individuals in the community hold demonstrations, vigils, workshops, services, and other events in common resistance with prisoners. The day to raise issues with the fact that a very high rate of women are in prison for protecting themselves against their abusers. This makes it obvious for the legal system It makes it obvious that the legal system does not protect women who suffer violence at the hand of other partners. It's the day to remember that there are disproportionate numbers of Native, African Canadian, and other minority and marginalized people in prison. Prisons are the ultimate form of oppression against struggles of recognition and self-determination. The day to raise public awareness of the demands made by prisoners to change the criminal justice system and the brutal and inhumane conditions that led so many prisoners' death. The day to oppose prison violence, police violence, and violence against women and children. The day to publicize that in their fight for freedom and equality, the action of many political prisoners have been criminalized by governments. As a result, they are false there are false claims that there are no political prisoners in North American prisons. The need to raise public awareness of the economic and social costs of a system of criminal justice which punishes for revenge. If there is ever to be a social justice, it will be only come about using a method of healing justice, connecting people to the crimes and helping offenders take responsibilities for their actions. The day to renew the struggle for HIV, AIDS, education, prevention, and treatment in prison. The day to remind people that the criminal justice system and the psychiatric systems are mutually reinforcing methods that the state uses to control human beings. There is a lot of brutality by staff committed in the name of treatment. Moreover, many deaths in the psychiatric prisons remain uninvestigated. 2001 Prisoner Justice Day Committee. Over the past years, Prison Justice Day has been both about commemorating people who have died inside and also about protesting conditions inside. It has always been political, a protest. There is always a component of recognizing and remembering people who have died for terrible reasons, but there is also always a recognition of the need to fight, to keep fighting, and to change society in its whole.
This is the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. You're listening to a pre-recorded episode of our show featuring audio from Montreal's Prisoner Justice Day event, which happened on Tuesday, August 10th. This next segment is in French, and it is also MC Joanne Wendy Barreto talking about her story and her experiences in prison.
Donc, comme j'ai dit, mon nom est Joanne Wendy Barreto. Je suis une sentence de vie. J'ai été condamnée en 2010, meurtre au deuxième degré, pour avoir tué la personne qui avait tenté de me violer. Ça faisait 10 ans que j'avais des problèmes de consommation de drogue et puis communément appelé le runner que j'avais appelé pour me livrer ce soir-là a décidé que... puis ça, je fais des jokes, mais c'est ma façon de passer à travers ce petit discours-ci. Là. C'est un little something something ce soir-là. Et puis moi, avoir été agressée à l'âge de 5 ans, j'ai passé ma vie à dire qu'en étant femme, je suis capable de me défendre. Fait que moi, le flight, je l'ai eu, mais... J'ai aussi le fight dans moi. C'est fait partie pourquoi je suis une survivante aussi. Alors, mon intention n'était pas de tuer mon agresseur, mais de l'incapacité. Et j'étais en train de me faire garde-robe. Puis la seule chose que j'avais à côté de moi, c'était un marteau. Et j'ai vraiment perdu un petit peu la map. Jusqu'à ce jour, j'ai aucune mémoire des coups. La majorité des coups que j'ai essayés, on dit peut-être que ça va me revenir, peut-être que pas. Moi, je souhaite que non, mais... Alors, et c'est ça. Après 2 ans d'attente et un procès, j'ai plaidé légitime défense et ça n'a pas passé parce que j'ai été condamnée meurtre au deuxième degré. La raison que je vous explique mon histoire à moi, c'est parce que c'est pas une histoire qui sort de l'ordinaire, OK? Quand je suis rentrée en incarcération, j'ai fait mon 2 ans au maximum. Moi, j'étais agent d'immeuble avant. Fait que même si j'avais un problème de consommation de drogue, je fonctionnais quand même parfait bien, une fois de temps en temps, tu sais. Fait que moi, la justice, j'étais vraiment... je vais le dire, very white et middle class. Fait que la police était là pour nous protéger, la justice, c'était juste. Tu sais, c'était... puis, je veux pas insulter, mais moi, je me rappelle, je descendais la 15, puis je voyais des gens nettoyer dans le milieu de terre-plein, puis je disais, mais pourquoi ils n'utilisent pas les prisonniers? Enfin, ça. C'était vraiment, là, c'était vraiment ma vision de la vie, là, dans le petit cocon là, que j'étais dedans, tu sais, là. Alors, quand ça m'est arrivé, j'ai vraiment eu un réveil. La justice n'est pas juste. La justice, c'est quel bord peut dire son histoire le mieux possible. Puis, la vérité et les faits ne rentrent nullement... ça rentre pas dans l'équation, là. Alors, j'ai fait 2 ans au maximum. Puis, quand je suis sortie du maximum... Par pur hasard, je suis tombée présidente du comité des détenus. J'ai commencé à lire les directives du commissaire, création de choix, le rapport Arbo, puis je me suis aperçue que j'avais des droits. Ça faisait 2 ans que je suis au maximum, que je faisais aucun droit. Je me faisais niaiser. On me faisait... ça, là. Moi, je suis une historienne, hein? Fait que la révélation féministe, puis tout ça, là. Faire donner un rapport, parce que j'avais pas de brassière autour d'un coton ouaté, là. Moi, j'étais comme... on les a brûlés, nos brassières, là. Ça fait longtemps, là. Fait que juste le fait que c'était vraiment oppressif, surtout dans une détention de femmes, c'est vraiment oppressif, on est des femmes, là. Le stéréotype qu'on voit souvent à l'extérieur, il est comme quintuplé, il est 10 fois pire à l'intérieur, là. On se la voit, on est agressif. Si on fait valoir nos droits, on est dans notre cycle criminel. Tu sais, c'est vraiment... moi, je me suis même fait mesurer une jupe. Tu sais, là, j'aurais cru au lycée. Tu sais, si ma jupe était trop courte. Puis j'étais en prison, là. Fait que j'ai commencé à travailler pour les femmes. Les deux spirited, les transgenres. J'ai commencé à faire de l'activisme à l'intérieur, là. Puis... c'est là que je me suis aperçue que mon histoire, là, elle sort... Puis ça, c'est triste, là, puis je vais pleurer, ça sort pas du commun. Moi, je n'aime pas le nom, mais j'ai une femme, là, que des rapports de police, par-dessus rapports de police, qu'elle se faisait battre par son conjoint un soir, il décide, il veut la rebattre, elle a un paring knife dans les mains. Une fois, un coup de couteau, mais elle pogne dans le cœur. Mais là, c'est clair, là, il n'y a pas, mais elle est en prison. Être en prison. Des gens qui sont... des histoires comme ça, il y en a, la plupart des femmes qui sont incarcérées pour des crimes qu'on appelle des crimes majeurs, c'est tous des crimes de protection, pas de... non. Je ne veux pas de généraliser, mais la plupart, c'est des crimes de protection, des crimes de survie. C'est pas à l'intérieur qu'on voit. Puis, ce qui vient me toucher encore plus, c'est d'écouter des nouvelles, puis de voir un homme blanc, le Bucci case, de voir un homme blanc qui protège son pick-up, qui tue un homme de Première Nation en arrière de la tête, puis pff, fuck all. Lui est encore chez eux, avec sa petite famille, puis tout est beau. Tu sais? Fait que si t'es femme de Première Nation, qui est la démographie la plus, qui augmente le plus, là, c'est les femmes autochtones. OK? On dit que le niveau de criminalité au Canada baisse, mais les femmes autochtones, il y en a plus en prison. Il y a quelque chose qui ne marche pas, là. OK? Il y a moins d'hommes blancs, mais il y a plus de Première Nation. Il y a plus de femmes de Première Nation. Il y a plus de femmes incarcérées. OK? Mais on n'est encore pas assez incarcérées pour avoir un système adéquat. On a moins d'éducation à l'intérieur. On a moins de programmes de travail à l'intérieur. On a moins de personnel à l'intérieur. Puis on est les plus... les gens qui se battent le moins aussi. Pourquoi on se bat le moins? Puis ça, c'est moi, quand je parle pour moi, là, c'est ma vision des choses. Mais les femmes s'occupent des enfants puis ils veulent pas rester à l'intérieur. Puis quand tu te bats en dedans, là, tu sors pas. À moins que tu aies un end date, là. Fait que si tu es une longue sentence ou une sentence vie puis tu te bats pour tes droits, tu ne sors pas de prison. OK? C'est presque sûr que tu vas rester là longtemps. Fait que les femmes ont tendance à... Moi, je voulais vraiment parler de la situation des femmes autochtones incarcérées. Puis qu'il faut que ça change. Puis c'est ça. Merci.
Up next, we have a speech from Sherry Pronto in English. For those of you just tuning in, this is audio from Montreal's Prisoner Justice Day, which happens every year on August 10th. The day commemorates people who have died in prison, as well as prisoner struggles for liberation. The speeches are a bit heavy. Everyone's talking about their experiences in prison and their life experiences, and this next speech has a bit of swearing in it.
I'm really nervous. I don't like speaking in front of people. Anyways, my name is Sherry Pronto. I'm First Nations from Pine Creek, Manitoba. I grew up mainly in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and I come from the North End. That's where my family is. Basically, I was born and raised in the North End of Winnipeg. A lot of my family came from residential school, my grandparents' residential school, all my older siblings, residential school survivors, and one of my brothers just recently passed away due to all the residential school news coming out because he was very hard on drugs, had a very hard life, and so I'm kind of dealing with that too right now. I'm serving a life sentence for manslaughter. I was convicted of manslaughter in Winnipeg in 1997. I didn't kill anybody. It's the people that actually did do the thing are already serving their life sentences as well. I just chose not to testify, and I chose not to plead guilty. So, and with my who my family was and organized crime and the people that I was charged with, they just threw me. They just threw me under the bus, and they're like, you know what, you don't want to testify, you don't want to plead guilty, so you know what, fuck yourself, here's a life sentence, and we hope you never get out. The judge's words were, there was no realistic prospect for rehabilitation for me, and I was like 17 years old. I wasn't even an adult yet. Anyways, they threw me away. I was really angry for the first half of my sentence, I guess for the first 7 to 10 years. I was like super angry. In all of that time, like, I slit my own throat. I have scars that I have a lot of stories about. I watched, people die. I watched people commit suicide. I've watched people wither inside, and I've seen people, I've done time with people that, were basically like me, that were there, that shouldn't have been there, and that are, wrongly convicted and, suffering. A lot of everybody in jail has their own trauma stories, but a lot of the Indigenous people have like double trauma stories just due to residential schools and the abuse. And I think that, we need to, stand together and just, focus on bringing our people home and bringing healing. Because there is no healing in prison. I never got any healing. I never got any real, anything in prison. What I became in prison was very cold. I became really hard. I became really, you couldn't question my word, and you couldn't challenge my word, because I was so angry and so just that, it wasn't okay. I didn't tolerate a lot of things. And the main thing I didn't tolerate was people bullying other people, taking advantage of, sisters and women with mental health issues and stuff like that. I wasn't, they labeled me a fighter for widows and orphans. I stood up for, my sisters. I was a chairperson of the inmate committees and the Native sisterhoods, and I made sure that, our rights were respected. Because after my first, 12 years of being angry and fighting and sitting in maximum security, and I did about four and a half years total in segregation. Normally, the smallest bit I did was 6 months at a time. So I did a lot. I seen a lot. And, I think that, my thoughts are all over the place. Please forgive me. If anybody has any questions, don't be shy to ask, because I wasn't really sure what I was coming to speak about tonight. But with the work that I'm doing now, I started with the Indigenous Support Workers Project of Montreal, which is basically a grassroots, it's Indigenous working to help our Indigenous homeless out there. We figure that, it's going to be us that's going to help each other get off the streets and put down the bottle and try to move forward. So what we do with the Indigenous Support Worker Project is that every weekend we go out there and we tell our people, you're worth it. We care about you. And, there's better things than, coming out of jail and becoming homeless right away. And that's one of the things that really, messes with my heart and my mind, is because I see my sisters coming out of jail and I see them right on the homelessness and, addicted and, hurting for money. And that doesn't make no sense. That doesn't make any fucking sense. I'm sorry for my language, but it angers me. And then our sisters are out, they come out of jail, and then, they're subject to, sexual violence. a lot of our sisters that come out of jail, you know, they suffer rapes because, you know, they don't have any support. There's no proper support for our people coming out of the prison system. And the reason that they are involved in the prison system is because they get criminalized out here. You know, they don't have bus fare. They don't have metro passes. So they jump. They get fines. And these fines accumulate and accumulate. And our people go inside. And a lot of them end up dying because a lot of them have serious, serious issues, health issues and addictions that are way bigger than them. If they don't have that drink in the morning, they go into seizures. They fall down. So imagine they get arrested. They go into jail. And that's where they die. And, you know, it's really fucked up if you ask me. And I wish that, you know, one of my dreams is that I can have a, you know, a center that I could hold for Indigenous people and that we could support people coming out of prison, help our sisters and our people coming out of prison, you know, be more successful. You know, I've been on parole in Montreal for 11 years now, and it's been super, super hard. It's been a long time. And I feel that with the Indigenous Support Workers Project, that's what gives me the strength as I see my people at their lowest. And I was at my lowest at one point. You know, I was all about that alcoholism. I was all about that gang life. I was all about that money. And I was all about that solidarity. And I did my whole prison sentence like that. You know, I was the guards, people, security. And I was like, well, why don't you talk? You know, why do you always protect people? I'm like, I'm not protecting people, man. I was like, I'm protecting myself. I was like, you know, people don't understand that, you know, it's, you know, just because I say I'm doing a life sentence and I did about approximately 19 years of that inside. And, you know, I was angry that I did so much time for something that I didn't do. But, you know, I got tossed inside because I refused to testify. And it's just like nobody understood until I actually pushed myself for parole and actually talked to my victim's family. Like, it was the first time I got to address them in 17 years. And, you know, for that whole 17 years, they hated me. They blamed me for their kid's death. And it was an unfortunate series of events that, you know, took his life. Just senseless. It was basically senseless. I got a life sentence simply because the gang that I was involved with was an Indian posse, and it was like a native gang, north end of Winnipeg, very tight. And, you know, there's always gang violence, and the cops never really cared because we were always killing each other. But in this situation, it was the first time that the native gangs killed a white person. So it was like, they sensationalized it. It was a very big thing. And they're like, oh my God, they're not killing each other anymore. They're killing us now. So it was like, it was basically a us and them situation when it came to my case. And, you know, I refused to testify and I refused to plead guilty for something that I didn't do. So one of the other persons that I got charged with was supposed to be a full-fledged gang member. He's like, and who was the organizer of the crime crew that he was with. He was the one that ended up testifying and, you know, putting me in his place, which secured me getting a life sentence. And, you know, I'm still fighting it today. And one of my last resorts that I have to have my sentence and my conviction overturned is what is known as a royal prerogative of mercy. It's basically I can ask the Justice Minister of Canada and to, you know, overturn my conviction and sentence. And if not, well, you know what? I've already been living with this life sentence for more than 23 years. And I'm not doing too bad. I've been very successful in my release. I have a son. He's somewhere running around. He's 9 years old, and it's, you know, I live and breathe for him. I live and breathe for freedom. I live and breathe for the opportunity to, you know, to move forward, to help people along the way. And that's basically it. I want to pay forward everything good that has been blessed to me since I've been out. And I don't know what else to say. I'm very nervous. I know my story's all over the place. I always get, you know, distracted in my ways of telling it. But, you know, my point is that, you know, I'm very grateful for my life every day. And I'm very blessed for, you know, my freedom. Like, It's not easy, you know, to, one of the things I got hired on recently with the Canadian Association Elizabeth Fry Societies, and they hired me on as their advocacy liaison. So I'm in a position where I can help like all like Indigenous people, all the Indigenous females inside. And one of the things I'm doing is we're trying to create an Indigenous organization to help challenge, I guess, what is known as a Section 8184, where, you know, where we could basically apply to be supervised by our own communities, like reserves. But if you notice, like, we don't even have clean drinking water on the reserve. So that thing that is sit there, it's unrealistic. You know, if you think about it, a lot of the people that you see in Montreal that are homeless in this city is because the resources aren't there in their own communities. So, you know, the Section 8184, it's, you know, it's kind of, it's fallen through the cracks. There's, you know, there's loopholes that we need to figure, and we need to challenge it so that, you know, our people that are inside, especially mothers, you know, mothers serving a life sentence, like, I can't imagine being taken away from my son and, you know, the trauma that would cause to him. Because since I've been out and since I've had him, like, I've broken every generational curse that, you know, that my family is still suffering through back home. Like I said, I just lost one of my brothers to, he was a super, super heavy drug user. And he was a very, very cold individual. He did time on several murders, more than three, let me say that. And it was just because he was angry. I call it arrested development. Ever since he was raped by the priests in the residential schools, he never, ever got over it. Like, I remember he was, like, one of my greatest protectors while I was a little girl. My family liked to drink. My family liked to be violent. My grandparents were especially violent because they were ones most affected by the residential schools. And when I was one and a half, my mother was brutally murdered. She was missing. My mother was missing, and she was brutally murdered. And then 6 months after her death, my father died because, I guess, you know, heartbreak. He couldn't handle the fact that she was murdered the way that she was. And he was a sugar diabetic, and he was dependent on insulin shots. So he basically drank himself to death. He drank and drank, and he wasn't taking his medicine. So he had, like, he went into a, what you call a diabetic coma, and then the cops arrested him. And thinking that he was drunk, they put him in the drunk tank and they just left him there, and that's where he died. So, you know, I never had my parents. I was raised by my maternal grandparents, and this is the first time me speaking about my dad dying in custody. And that's why one of the things I touch base on is because, you know, like, it's, you know, the system is cold. You know, I think that, you know, we could do a lot better for our people. I think that, you know, people don't have to go inside and die and, you know, in such a cold and heartless system, because, you know, that's what it is. Like, I've seen, like I said, I've seen people wither. I've withered, you know. I went into some very, very dark places. I almost cut off my own head, like, by slicing my own throat. I went into some real mental destruction. I also picked up like another 20 years on top of my life sentence, and another 15 years, how angry I was. You know, there was a lot of racism inside. The whites were like, they called us, like, you know, despicable names, like despicable things. They'd egg us on, tease us, and it broke me. It broke me to the point where I destroyed a prison. I set it on fire. I took hostages. I tortured hostages. And I'm not proud of it. I'm not proud of the things that I did. But it's just to show you that, like, I went to some very dark places. And I was very angry. And, like, to be inside there. And, you know, I had one of my cousins come in there. And I didn't know she was my cousin at the time. But I watched a spirit come into the prison that, you know, didn't belong there. But because she loved the person that she was with, she just took the beef with them. And she's like, okay, I'll take the beef. And she thought she could do it. And she came in, and, you know, she just, from the day she walked in, I watched her wither and die. And it broke my heart. Because, you know, it's like, especially women, you know, we take a lot of responsibility on our shoulders as, you know, as life givers and, you know, as wives and girlfriends. And, you know, we want to protect our people. We want to protect our families and our partners. And it's really sad, you know, like we have to take better care, you know, and, you know, we can't let our people go in and die. I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm so sorry. Oh, I'm so shy. So what's next? I don't know what's going on. I don't know what else to say. Thank you for listening. Anyways, my name is Sherry, and thank you.
The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside. That was a speech from Sherry Pronto speaking at Montreal's Prisoner Justice Day. After Sherry spoke, Fallon took the mic and was followed by Guadeloupe. Both Fallon and Guadeloupe are members of Solidarity Across Borders, a migrant justice organization in Montreal. Here are their speeches in French and Spanish, and then Fallon translates Guadeloupe's speech.
Allô? Well, not easy to speak after that. Thank you so much. Merci tellement d'avoir pris la parole. Ouais, si je peux faire un peu de storytelling aussi, ben moi quand je suis née, mes deux parents étaient en prison, puis je suis née en prison aussi. J'ai passé 3 semaines là, puis après ça, j'ai été chez mes grands-parents, puis back and forth avec les entrées et sorties de mes parents. Fait que c'est ça, la prison a toujours été vraiment dans ma vie. Ma vie a toujours été rythmée un peu par les entrées et sorties de mes parents, puis... Quand je suis déménagée à Montréal vers 17-18 ans, j'ai commencé à m'impliquer dans des luttes anticarcérales, anti-détention, des luttes contre les frontières. Puis ça m'a un peu comme donné la force de politiser mon histoire puis mon existence, je pense, de comme rencontrer des personnes abolitionnistes à Noir, puis d'avoir une critique solide de la prison. Puis c'est ça. En 2012 aussi, je faisais beaucoup de sport avec les gens qui avaient été arrêtés, etc. Puis c'est drôle parce qu'en 2012, c'est aussi l'année où est-ce que mes deux parents sont retournés en prison pour des choses complètement différentes. Puis moi, en 2013, je suis rentrée en prison. Je suis rentrée en prison au Mexique, puis on m'a accusée de terrorisme. Puis j'ai passé 1 an et demi là, mais jusqu'à la fin, on savait pas quand est-ce qu'on allait sortir. Comme notre sentence, c'était 20 ans. Puis c'est ça, dans le fond, c'était... Finalement, on est sortis après 1 an et demi, puis on est sortis... avec une toute petite charge comparée à la charge qu'ils nous avaient donnée au début. Puis un peu comme certaines stratégies, là, on n'est ni coupable ni innocente. On n'a jamais accepté, dans le fond, le système de justice. On n'a jamais corroboré avec ce système de justice-là parce qu'on l'a toujours critiqué. Puis c'est sûr que je parle d'une position de privilégié, certainement canadienne en prison au Mexique. C'est clair que je ne parle pas de la même position, mais c'est ça, c'était un moyen de résistance pour nous, je pense, de... refuser ce système-là, refuser l'aide de l'ambassade du Canada aussi, refuser comme toutes les possibilités qu'on aurait eues d'utiliser nos privilèges, dans le fond, je pense qu'on les a pas faits. Certainement, nos privilèges ont joué pour nous quand on était en prison, c'est sûr, mais en tout cas, on n'a jamais voulu comme corroborer avec l'État, les flics et la justice. Puis, c'est ça, ce qui est fou, c'est que au Mexique, ben, c'est ça, t'es coupable jusqu'à preuve du contraire. Fait que des fois, t'as comme une première sentence de 20 ou 40 ans. Puis si t'as pas d'argent pour payer un avocat, pour faire un appel à ta cause, ben, tu restes en dedans. Puis quand que t'as une sentence de moins de 5 ans, tu peux sortir de prison puis tu payes une caution. Puis souvent, ce qui se passe, c'est qu'il y a beaucoup d'afro-descendantes, indigenous people qui sont à l'intérieur, puis qui n'ont pas assez d'argent pour payer leur, je sais pas, le 3000 pesos pour sortir. Fait qu'ils font leur sentence. Des fois, c'est 4 ans pour avoir volé un dentifrice, tu sais. Puis c'est toutes des choses de survie. Puis la population carcérale dans laquelle, moi, en tout cas, j'étais, les gens étaient tellement fucking jeunes. Ça a commencé à 18 ans. Puis quand on rencontre qu'ils ont 20 ans, ça fait déjà deux fois qu'ils viennent. Puis ils ont des enfants à l'extérieur. Puis c'est un peu ça, le... Tu sais, en tout cas, c'est juste une manière de... Un témoignage de plus à quel point la prison, c'est une forme d'incarcération. C'est un système d'oppression qui te pogne dès que t'es jeune puis qui te garde là-dedans toute ta vie. Puis après ça, c'est intergénérationnel aussi. Puis c'est ça. Puis, en tout cas, je pense que je suis vraiment comme heureuse d'être ici aujourd'hui puis d'entendre vos témoignages parce que c'est vrai que la prison, ça te tue, tu sais, ça te tue de l'intérieur, ça l'essaye en tout cas de te tuer, ça te coupe de ton corps, ça te coupe de tes relations, ça te coupe de l'amour, ça te coupe... On dirait que pour survivre, il faut que tu deviennes fucking tough, tu sais. Puis je pense que la plus belle réussite, c'est d'être aujourd'hui ici puis de pouvoir en parler. Puis de reconnecter un peu avec notre amour intérieur, je sais pas comment dire, mais comme de je sais pas, ça te rend tellement rough, puis c'est nice de voir le courage, en tout cas, que vous avez aujourd'hui d'être ici, puis de parler de votre expérience. Puis c'est ça aussi, je pense que la lutte continue, puis c'est ça qui est important de voir aussi, puis que, tu sais, aujourd'hui, il y a des centres de détention qui sont en train de se faire construire à Laval, je pense que c'est important de lutter contre ça aussi. Les frontières, puis les prisons, c'est des luttes qui sont complètement interreliées, puis... Moi, quand j'étais au Mexique, c'est ça, on a passé 3 semaines en détention, dans un centre de détention, puis ça m'a vraiment marqué de voir des jeunes de 19 ans, 20 ans, que ça faisait 3 fois qu'ils essayaient de passer aux États-Unis, ils partaient du Guatemala, ils montaient au Honduras, ils montaient, puis essayaient d'aller jusqu'aux States, puis ils se faisaient prendre au Mexique, remettre en détention. Puis tu vois que c'est juste un système économique qui roule là-dessus, tu sais. Puis en tout cas, moi, c'est entre autres pour ça aujourd'hui que je m'implique plus avec Solidarité sans frontières, puis... que je trouve ça vraiment important d'avoir une analyse anticarcérale puis anti-frontière en même temps, parce que c'est des choses qui sont vraiment interreliées. Puis c'est ça. Je vais m'arrêter là pour laisser la parole à une membre de Solidarité sans frontières, justement, qui va venir un peu parler de son expérience. Puis je vais faire la traduction après, parce qu'elle va s'adresser en espagnol.
Bonjour. Hola, yo me llamo Guadalupe, soy de nacionalidad mexicana. Estoy en Montreal desde el 2009, luchando por un estatus y por mis derechos. Soy miembro de Solidaridad Sin Fronteras y soy sobreviviente de violencia misógena en base de género, ya que tengo mucho miedo a las deportaciones, ya que me tocó ver cómo la policía detenía a varios compañeros de trabajo y en especial a un compañero que vivía conmigo, que compartía vivienda, el cual tuvieron detenido 1 mes en el centro de detención en Laval, hasta que lo deportaron a su lugar de origen. Hoy en día sigo siendo miembro activo de Solidaridad Sin Fronteras, el cual yo hago llamadas a los centros de detenciones en a diferentes personas de algunos países como Cuba, Colombia, El Salvador y Chile. Ya han sido algunas personas deportadas y otras siguen en el centro de detención. Y yo estoy esperando la respuesta de inmigración. Para mí esto es algo difícil porque hay muchas personas que quieren estar sin, ¿cómo les puedo decir? Sin ninguna cárcel, no tener ninguna detención y pues es algo difícil para la gente. Y es todo lo que tengo que decir.
Je vais traduire rapidement en français. Bonjour, je m'appelle Guadalupe et je suis d'origine mexicaine. Je suis à Montréal depuis 2009 et je lutte pour avoir un statut légal ainsi que pour mes droits. Je suis membre de Solidarité sans frontières et survivante de violences misogynes. J'ai très peur des déportations. J'ai vu comment la police arrête plusieurs personnes avec qui j'ai travaillé, en particulier une personne avec qui je vivais. Ils l'ont gardé prisonnier du centre de détention à Laval pendant plus d'un mois avant de le déporter dans son pays d'origine. C'est pour cette raison qu'aujourd'hui encore, je suis membre de Solidarité sans frontières. Je fais entre autres des appels à la prison pour migrants et parle avec les personnes détenues. Certains et certaines ont été déportés alors que d'autres attendent encore des réponses d'Immigration du Canada. Je vis avec la peur constante de me faire déporter et je crois que c'est important de lutter.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at www.ckut.ca. We are in the midst of sharing audio from Montreal's Prisoner Justice Day event, which happened on August 10th in Parc Vinet in Little Burgundy. August 10th is a day started by prisoners in the 1970s to commemorate prisoners who have died in prison and to come together to demand better conditions for prisoners. This is the last speech from the event, and it is by Donald, and it is in English.
Hi, everybody. I'm so happy to see everybody here tonight. It's a good-sized crowd, and it makes my heart pump fast. Thank you. I got the privilege tonight to speak about prison abolition. I know that's a big subject, and I don't have the answers to the big subject. But I'll give you some of my background. I survived 40 years in the federal prison system in couple of different provinces and Quebec, Ontario for the most part, and I was lucky enough to survive it, come out and find a life out here, which I thank all you guys for, actually. But prison abolition, early in the 80s, I had the experience of dealing with a Quaker lady that used to come in the prison and for groups for the lifers, and she would speak about abolition movement. You know, how it worked with slavery, women's rights, and all those other things. And for the life of me, I didn't understand it. I thought, what, is she crazy? They're going to let, you know, I'm in a prison, maximum security prison, with 400 guys. And truthfully, a good portion of them I wouldn't want to live in my neighborhood now. You know, and I'm saying, you know, they're going to let 400 mostly convicted murderers out on the street, but that's not what it was about. I missed the point, and most people missed the point. It's not about closing the prisons today. It's a gradual step to ending incarceration by finding other means of justice, by putting the resource, a huge amount of resources go into this federal prison system, astronomical amount of money that I think it's on a federal budget, it's the third item, the third most costly item on a federal budget after health care. So, you know, go figure what all that money would do. You know, most people I met in prison over the years had come in because they had childhood issues, drug addiction, broken families, coming from reservations where peer abuse and abuse from the residential schools, all those places. If the proper resources are put at the front end of the system, childhood needs, you know, guaranteed income for a family, all those items, you're going to have less people end up in the prison justice system. Deal with the problems when kids are young. I had problems when I was young. Most of my peer group, you know, had problems when they were growing up. Very few people that I ever met in jail suddenly at 24 decide to be a criminal. It's not quite the way it works from my experience. You know, but I don't have the answers of how to get there. We had a generation in the 70s that got together and stopped the death penalty. Prison abolition and defunding prisons is a much bigger issue than the death penalty was. But people did come together and make change with the death penalty. You know, if your computer's broken and you put resources into it repeatedly, you know, a new hard drive, a new monitor, and the thing's still broken, what do you do with it? You get rid of it. And that's what the prison system is. Yes, there's been times where the prison system tried to change and made efforts towards it. They brought in university education, all kinds of things. Corcan Industries that paid wages that you could help your family, that you get out of prison with some money in your pocket. But then a conservative government come in and said, those are luxuries. and they cut them all. You know, so the prison system needs to be abolished. It can't be fixed. If it could be fixed, all the efforts that went into it so far. And prisoners can't fix it. A prisoner in the system that speaks up and gets political dies in prison. On the table over there, there's a booklet of Peter Collins. Peter Collins could have been anything in the world, but he fought the prison system. And for it, he died. And tonight, I'd like to remember Peter. You know, he died for a belief that, as it turns out, may not be the proper way to go. Prison activism is nice. It helps at times. But the big problem always remains. The prison system still has the same problems it did in 1975. You know, prisoners are getting abused. A two-spirited inmate in Port Cartier had his arm broken a few weeks ago because he was two-spirited. You know, that the system doesn't learn from its mistakes. And what do you do when something's broken? You get rid of it. And I think that's something that we start having to look towards ourselves. How are we going to do that? You can't ask an inmate that's sitting in his cell to change the system he's in. He's caught. If he fights, he dies. He stays in prison. Because one of the things about getting out of prison, you have to show change. And they don't view somebody that's political as changed. And sadly, the most political people are the ones that would be the most successful out here, because we would welcome them in our midst here. They would be organizing. You know, but the prison system just kills them. They will not give them parole. There's all kinds of literature online about abolition, but we've got to start the discussion.
Welcome back to CKUT. This was a broadcast from yesterday from the Prison Radio Show here at the station. If you want to hear more, you can find all of their content and more through ckut.ca.
I'm Brian Jefferson. As we wrap today's episode of Off the Hour, we'll bring you some news that you can use. And Montreal's official Pride event is set for this weekend. There's a march this Sunday instead of the usual parade. It starts at noon at Jean Mons Park and ends in the Gay Village. The Montreal Pride Parade is the largest celebration of its kind in the Francophone world. The city's first Pride celebration was in 1979. It marked 3 years after the mass raids of gay and lesbian bars before the 1976 Olympics. And it's almost a month since the Tribunal Administratif du Logement, or Rental Board, introduced new rules about leases. A landlord has historically had to inform new tenants of the lowest rent paid in the last 12 months. As of the end of July, landlords now have to disclose the last rent paid, regardless of if it was in the last year. And there's a free film screening coming soon to 77 Rue Bernard East, or L'Entrepôt 77. Migrant Dreams is about migrant farm workers struggling against systemic oppression in a small Ontario town. Although the screening is in 2 weeks, this story is shared at a time when Quebec farm workers are facing dangerous work conditions. A man from Guatemala who came to work as a farmer in Quebec died this week on August 10th. His name was Oscar Antonio Vicente Torres. He was struck by lightning while on the job cutting cauliflower and is survived by his wife and daughter. And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes me, Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Kate Addison, Joel Salmadal, and Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041 extension 7000, or newsintern@ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on Instagram at OffTheHourMTL, or connect with us on Facebook. Just search for us, CKUT. Stay tuned for Cafe coming up next on 90.3 FM CKUT.
When you hear the words mental illness, what do you think?
I have friends who don't even know that I suffer from depression.
Why don't they know?
Because I'm scared they'll ostracize me if they know, and then they'll abandon me. I don't want to be alone.
You're discriminated against when you have a mental illness. With other illnesses, there's compassion.
It doesn't take much to be diagnosed mentally ill. Due to an outbreak.
C'est Alex qui vous parle en direct de la maison d'été d'Anthony. Donc, bonsoir Anthony.
Bonsoir tout le monde, on est bien, il fait chaud, c'est humide.
Donc, vous êtes à votre émission préférée d'art et culture, l'émission Café sur les ondes de CKUT. Et nous sommes vendredi le 13 août.
Donc, ce soir Alex, qu'est-ce qu'on a préparé à nos auditeurs et à nos auditrices?
Oui, on a une émission très
diversifiée, hein, c'est ce que tu
dis. Merci, Anto. Je pense que je viens de sentir le 40 degrés dont tu me parlais un peu plus tôt. Donc, une émission très diversifiée. Donc, Anthony, pour commencer, tu vas nous parler de...
D'un recueil de textes qui s'appelle « Pauvreté », que sous la direction de Stéphanie Roussel. Je n'en dis pas plus parce que je vous laisse l'eau à la bouche.
Super. Puis après ça, nous avons donc eu la chance d'avoir en entrevue notre fidèle collaboratrice à l'émission Café, Esther Bourdage, sur sa participation et la programmation de la rencontre des arts médiatiques en Gaspésie. Donc, nous allons l'avoir à l'émission. Et pour terminer, je vais vous parler d'un balado que j'ai dévoré cet été, soit le balado « Je suis noire et je n'aime pas Beyoncé », créé par Axel Jan Jiquet et produit par France Culture en juin dernier.